Monster Man, special episode, I Fell in Love with the Majesty of Colors.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
Today's episode is a special episode brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular of Patreon backer Ted. If you'd like to be like Ted and get your own special episode, all you have to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, in addition to your own special episode, you'll also get the other rewards, including monthly bonus content from me, as well as my other podcast, Patron Deities, which is approaching its 100th episode and is all about using religion and mythology in your fantasy RPGs, as seen through the lens of the old Deities and Demigods book. So Ted, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoy this episode. So Ted asked me to talk about the monster from a computer game called I Fell in Love with the Majesty of Colors. Now, this was originally an online game. It was like a Flash game, but obviously that's not a thing anymore. But it has since been remastered and is available on Steam, which is the version that I played. So although they are technically different, they look very similar. I could have just watched somebody play it on YouTube because it's not a very long game, but it was less than £2, so I thought, you know, why not? It's very short, as I said. It has a simple pixel art style. Basically, there are a series of decisions in it that can kind of lead you to different end states. I think there are 5 end states or something like that. I've only played through to get about 3 of them. So the premise of this game is that you play a sea monster, a huge creature with tentacles and 3 glowing red eyes. Obviously, the tentacles and the 3 glowing red eyes evoke the work of H.P. Lovecraft. You know, the tentacles being kind of Cthulhu-y and the 3 red eyes resembling the 3-lobed red eye from The Haunter of the Dark. But you are not such a bad monster, you're just very alien to the world above you. Indeed, initially you kind of inhabit this undersea world that's all in black and white until you discover, you know, the world above, and you, as the title says, fall in love with the majesty of colors. And the sea monster has to learn by trial and error how to get along with the humans that live next to its habitat. Or, you know, maybe it doesn't. You can definitely play it such that you wind up with a very antagonistic relationship and they, like, send a submarine down to torpedo you. Because you have no way to communicate with them and you only really have one way to interact, which is to grab things with your tentacles. So you might use your tentacles to do helpful things, like helping someone who's fallen out of their boat get to the rescue helicopter, or filling a fisherman's boat with fish, or alternatively, you might use them to do harmful things, like pulling a human off of his jet ski so that, you know, you can bring him down to your eyes and get a better look at him, and he drowns. Because you don't know that the human can't breathe water. You may wind up with a reputation for being a friendly, helpful monster, and then they'll, like, send a plane over with one of those trailing banners that just says, you know, we heart monster. And other times, you get the torpedoes. So, I had to think about this, and about the idea of playing monsters, something that we've talked about before on this show. I think that very few people outside quite a narrow sort of trench of the indie gaming scene are going to play a game where specifically you play tentacle monsters coming to terms with their awareness of a new world. We're probably going to be looking at the ways in which the kind of differing perceptions and the differing modes of interaction the monsters have kind of condition the experience of them in your game. You know, assuming that we are playing a more or less conventional RPG with more or less conventional protagonists, how do we incorporate some of these ideas into a game? Or do we? First up, my notes here just say, not Cthulhu. Obviously, the visual imagery of I Fell in Love with the Majesty of Colors in terms of how the monster is presented is intended to invoke the Cthulhu mythos. But there is nothing particularly otherworldly or weird about the monster's concerns. It wants to know what these strange things are, it wants to know whether the people want to be its friends, and it just doesn't have the means to convey its very normal and relatable feelings to the people around it. So this is more about two perspectives that struggle to communicate. The revelation that the cosmos is not humanocentric is core to Lovecraftian cosmic horror. But the assumption that therefore means that everything is crazy and everyone should go mad, that is itself a humanocentric assumption. What if we were to take on the alien perspective? In a way, this sort of reminds me of later Lovecraft. Like, in At the Mountains of Madness, we discover that the horrific mutilations inflicted on these dead humans by the Old Ones are merely a form, of scientific experiment. You know, the Old Ones have awoken in a confused world, and the Old Ones have awoken in an unfamiliar world, confused, and they are being attacked by these weird creatures, so they dissect them to try and find out what they are. You know, this is the kind of two-stage rug pulling that's fundamental to the success of At the Mountains of Madness. The Old Ones are not monsters, they're just aliens. The Shoggoths are both aliens and monsters. So in a sense, this is almost more like a science fictional narrative where this creature is an alien. Attempting to understand a creature that has some kind of barrier to communication could be the plot of an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, except, and this is crucial, that the game presents itself in this very everyday manner. We do not take on the role of the scientists investigating the monster. Now, in order for this setup to work, the monster has to cause harm. If you look at a lot of kind of classic monster stories, you will see that the monster is often a simple, misunderstood creature being persecuted by a bunch of panicky, superstitious yokels. Attempts to make monsters sympathetic often result in making them nicer, and that means that you just get people who are kind of persecuted by, you know, the panicky, superstitious locals of whatever village they're in, for looking different or for being different in some way. Now, obviously, that's a very, you know, potent metaphor for the way that discrimination works, but that is not about monsters. That is saying you are calling us monsters, but we are not monsters. It's a bit like the TV show Angel, where the attempt to humanize demons essentially, like, left impossible to answer the question of, in what sense are these demons? Right? The creatures in Angel are aliens. They're not demons. A lot of the time, they're just Star Trek people. So when we have a panicky pitchfork mob chasing anything different, you know, we're telling a very different story. In a gaming sense, this is a problem that doesn't need to exist. It's more like that Star Trek problem where the locals are a bunch of panicky idiots and you come down to the planet and talk good sense into them. But it's a problem that in some ways is very unsatisfying to resolve because all you are doing is revealing that there wasn't really a problem in the first place. But when there's a conflict between the humans and the monster in I Fell in Love with the Majesty of Colors, it's because the monster, maliciously or not, has caused harm, right? The humans start to get anxious about you when you go around drowning fools. The humans are reacting perfectly reasonably, if a little excitedly, to a giant tentacle creature that appeared out of nowhere and drowned a fella or whatever. So if the PCs are going to arrive in one of these situations, it has to not be the case that the locals are just being a bunch of dummies. When I was a kid, and I don't know why, when I was a kid, I hated that storyline. I think it's very common in kind of children's entertainment, and it always really annoyed me. I don't know why it annoyed me as a kid. As an adult, it annoys me because it's a metaphor for bigotry that, like, doesn't really hold up, because, at least in my view, people who are prejudiced are not prejudiced because they're afraid of people. That is something everybody says, but I do not think that it is the case. I think that fear is typically more like a post facto justification. I mean, this is a complex topic, and I don't want to reduce it to a simplistic moral tale in complaining about a simplistic moral tale. But I guess what I mean is that insofar as it's intended to teach a lesson, that lesson always seemed to me to be a little disconnected from reality. Anyway, so it's important that the monster not be an innocent victim. It has caused harm. The stakes of the miscommunication are very real. So you could then make this into a game of communication where the PCs arrive in this town, there's a monster, the locals are terrified of the monster, they ask the PCs to go, you know, solve their problem. And one of the ways the PCs can do that is by attempting to communicate with the monster and conveying to it that it is hurting people. But talking to the creature should be a weird process of trial and error. And this can be a little challenging in conventional fantasy games where a lot of the time, obstacles to communication are not a big part of the game, right? The idea of common, you know, that allows characters to communicate. Like, I'm not saying that's a bad thing. It's unrealistic, certainly. But it exists in order to facilitate roleplay, to facilitate communication between characters. And even when you run into something that doesn't speak your language, you've got people with comprehend languages, you've got people with ESP, whatever. So it's a bit of a cheat, but you would kind of have to assume that the creature here does not have language, right? There's no suggestion that the monster in I Fell in Love with the Majesty of Colors is one of a type, right? It very much seems to be something that has always been on its own. And I think that that works a little bit better. One way to put some urgency into this situation is if it's not like the PCs just, you know, wander up to some seaside village and the locals are like, hey, strangers, have you heard the tale of the tentacle monster? But instead that this is like blocking navigation in some way. The PCs need to get to this island where the blue jewel is hidden, but they can't get into the harbor because, you know, there's a big tentacle monster attacking people. Ships getting to a location and then being unable to get into harbor is actually something that used to happen all the time, most of the time because of like the direction of the wind. But ships used to like sail to Jamaica and then spend ages just not arriving at Port Royal. So that's one possibility, right? That there are humans and they are having trouble communicating with a creature, and the PCs wind up being the kind of people who have to solve the puzzle of alien communication. An alternative version would be to put the PCs somehow temporarily into the perspective of the creature, right? The game isn't about communicating with the monster, but it's about being the monster, a little bit closer to what the actual video game is like. So I think there are a couple of different ways to put your PCs in this position. The first is to send them to some other plane and have them interact with creatures that are as weird to them as the humans are to the monster. One key here is to limit the modes of interaction. So I said before that all the monster can do is grab things with its tentacles. You want to take away some of the more familiar ways in which PCs might try to communicate. You know, so maybe they're in an airless void, or like they're in the deafening factory of Mechanus where, you know, speech can't be heard or something like that. You have to cut off some of their communication advantages. One thing I always wanted to do with this would be to, like, I don't speak Latin. I did the first couple of units of Felix Latin, and I've done some, like, reading on, you know, how to read medieval Latin, because that came up in some of my stuff in grad school. Like, I would say that I probably have a better grip on communicating in Latin than most people who have not really studied Latin, but not compared to someone who speaks it. This is ideal. The reason I'm saying this is that I always wanted to have an alien species in my old Stars of That Number game whose deal was that they spoke a language that was similar to, but not the same as, the kind of common language that the PCs all spoke. And the way that I would do this would be like representing the speech of the aliens as being in my own crude gibberish Latin, because I think most people can figure out some of those words, right? So there would be an out of character element there where the creatures were talking nonsense, but like nonsense that you could kind of understand a little bit of, and through a combination of groping for familiar words and, you know, I don't know, drawing on the wall or whatever, you could have some form of communication. I think that would be kind of neat. It helped that there was a member of the party who could read minds a little bit. You know, that would have helped as well. But I think, you know, having some kind of real world substitute for the communication difficulty makes it more fun to play. Some players do not like that. Some players would feel like they were being made to do homework and that they would get tense. Because they feel like they're being evaluated. I was going to say some players, of course, will speak Latin, but the genius part of it, if I do say so myself, is that I don't speak Latin. So their ability to speak Latin would not necessarily qualify them any more than anyone else to understand what I was saying, because I was just talking pidgin Latin. I once went to a talk, this is over 20 years ago now, by the late Ken Campbell, and he was talking about what he called Wolwantok. Now, Wolwantok was Ken Campbell's plan to use pidgin English, I believe, as spoken in New Guinea, as a universal second language. Now, if you don't know what pidgin is, it is a simplified, small vocabulary, phonetically spelled, well, pidgin of English that was used to communicate in the Pacific between cultures that, like, did not otherwise have a language in common. And because it has some connection to English, although they're not identical, And because it has a comparatively small vocabulary, Campbell's argument was that it would be easy to learn and, you know, therefore facilitate communication between people who otherwise had, you know, some language barriers. And in particular, kind of the main way that people overcome language barriers today is that they use English as a shared language. You know, if a Chinese person and a Dutch person meet, chances are they will communicate in English. And that's a real pain because English is a complex and difficult language to learn. This was, you know, if you're familiar with his work, then this is of a piece with it. But I do think that there is something fun there because, you know, again, you could use Wol Wan Tok and players could maybe figure out bits of it from context in a way that would give them some way to communicate without being able to necessarily clearly express what they want. Man, I haven't thought about Wol Wan Tok in a long time, but I was talking frequently to Ted not long after I saw Ken's presentation. So I'm sure he's actually heard me go on about it over and over again. Anyway, so one way that you could do this thing of like limiting the PC's ability to interact would be to have them reach another plane, but like using some item. So it's not just like a big doorway opens up and they step into another plane, but they project into some kind of alien body that has limited means of interaction. That item transfers your consciousness or projects your consciousness into a body on the target plane, but it's something that seems monstrous to the plane's inhabitants. It's just a raw lump of cells or a shrieking shape of interplanar energy or an old stone idol. So while you are in that kind of projecting whatever it is, you're able to be present in that other plane, but your options for communicating are very limited and your options for interacting are very limited. So you, like the monster, would kind of have to figure out what was going on by some process of trial and error. I like the idea of planar travel by projecting into something that can survive on that plane, right? You know, you're going to the elemental plane of fire to, you know, have a chat with the salamanders. Well, it's not safe. It's very hot. Another thematic element that occurs in the game, and something that doesn't come up very much in fantasy gaming, is the idea of the wonder of a new environment, right? The monster emerges into the upper world of sunlight and air, and as the title says, falls in love with the majesty of colors. And that phrasing is so interesting because it is, of course, something that we all take for granted. We don't all see color in the same way, but we are used to the idea of seeing colors. And so you could have a monster that, you know, emerged from the Underdark and had only ever seen in dark vision or infravision and was unfamiliar with the idea of seeing in glorious sunlight full color. And that's a fun role-playing note for a more traditional fantasy game monster, or it could be an aspect of a game where you play a monster, right? Again, this sort of takes us back toward, you know, less traditional fantasy gaming, less traditional action adventure gaming, although you can combine them. Speaking of things, again, a game that Ted and I both played in once, I played a werewolf. This is the old game Werewolf the Apocalypse, and if you're familiar with that game, you know that there are werewolves who are born as humans and discover that they are werewolves and they turn into a wolf. There are werewolves who are born as werewolves and know about their heritage their whole lives. And there are werewolves who are born as wolves and discover that they're werewolves when they turn into a human. The human-born werewolves, homids as they're called, are characterized as, like, always having these kind of, like, animalistic urges that they don't really know where they come from. Like, why are they so angry? Why do they dream of hunting? And so I played a character who was kind of based on the question, like, well, what is that like if you're born as a wolf? And he was just endlessly delighted by things. You know, he'd grown up in the woods with a pack of wolves in Alaska. And he kept kind of being confronted by stuff that he didn't know anything about, but that he was delighted by. He was always learning new things, and he's very excited about it. As he said, until I was an adult, I thought that I was the only being in the entire world capable of abstract thought. So this is a real relief for me. So you could have a character who was a bit like that, who had sort of discovered, like, do you guys know about eating food? This stuff's amazing. This may be more of like a gimmick that applies to like a spirit that's taking material form for the first time. But I do think, you know, this is a whole other discussion. One of the things that comes up a lot in when archaeologists try to think about experience. So like trying to think about not just what is this object and what is it for, but how do people interact with it? And one of those things, of course, is to think about the senses, right? To think about the different ways in which people might interact with it. And sort of sensory archaeology is this whole field of trying to understand, you know, how people encounter different spaces, different objects, you know, things like that. And so I think that, you know, reminding the players of other characters' perceptions of the world around them can help make the world feel more vivid, you know, even if it's just instead of saying, "It is spring as you enter the woods that fringe the Tharkite marches, and the leaves on the trees are a bright green." If instead of saying that, you know, you have, you know, the angel that they've summoned into a human body going, "Wow, look at that green. What an amazing color. Did you ever see anything like it?" And the PCs go, "Yeah, it's a leaf. We see that all the time." And the angel goes, "Lucky." You can turn those bits of description into bits of interaction, which is nice. You can also bring the monster back later on. We're kind of getting into the bit where I've just written all my little bullet points. But what I mean is, you know, you could do that game where you're trying to figure out how to communicate with the creature. And then much later in the campaign, it returns again. Only now it's really perfected. It's, you know, speaking apparatus, whatever. It's got the two little singers from Mothra, or, you know, whatever. It's got its means of communicating with mortals, and it remembers you and kind of the effort that you put in to try and help communicate with it. You know, maybe it does you a favor, or maybe it remembers how you tried to torpedo it. There's a challenge in having the player characters fall in love with the majesty of colors. It's very difficult to describe in a game any sense that the players themselves don't possess, and it's very hard to make any sense that the players themselves do possess seem exciting and new. I think that is maybe a challenge that I would struggle with. But so yeah, I think that, you know, this game sort of gets me thinking off in a bunch of different directions, and that can only be a good thing. So Ted, thank you very much for suggesting that I take a look at I Fell in Love with the Majesty of Colors, and I hope that you enjoyed this episode. Everyone else, if you'd like to be like Ted and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. In our next episode, we'll be returning to Monstrous Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition. And we're gonna be taking a look at an old favorite. It's dinosaurs. All of that right here on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.